Hello. I'm Dennis Prager. Thank you for being with me. Welcome to my home. It is my home, as I remind you each week. This is the real deal. It's completely spontaneous. I'm not reading from any cards. And it is just a way to have a real, open, friendly, informal dialogue, because I take a lot of your questions too. So, great to be with you. I always open up with a few comments on a subject. The subject today is Israel. This is the 70th anniversary this month of the State of Israel. And I want to give you a few reflections on it, because if you're at college or were at college recently, the most hated place in the world is not the Iranian regime, which is the greatest supporter of terror on earth. It's not Russia, which supports Iran and supports the terrible tyrant of Syria, Assad. It isn't Syria. It isn't even North Korea, which is one large concentration camp. It's Israel. There are more student groups that are anti-Israel than any other country in the world, than any other thing in the world. And it needs to be explained, because Israel is a good place, is a humane place. Why of all the countries in the world is there so much activity against Israel, where they want colleges to sever ties with Israeli academics? This I could speak on for a whole hour at least, and I've written a book on it. In fact, it's called Why the Jews. But I'll tell you this, there's one pretty obvious reason, and that is that in all the world's 200 or so countries, there's only one Jewish country. Many Christian countries, many Muslim countries, many Buddhist, well, not many, but a few Buddhist countries, all sorts of countries. But there's only one Jewish country. It's the only country where Jews are the majority, and that's Israel. So unless you really want to be in a state of denial, it's very hard to say, well, it's a coincidence that the most reviled country in the world is also the only Jewish country in the world. In other words, I'm saying the obvious, that part of the hostility to Israel is ultimately an anti-Jewish hostility. Now, I know not everybody on a campus hates all Jews. I know that. Nobody hates all Jews. It's very rare that anybody hates. Hitler and the Nazis hated all Jews. That was about it. Throughout history, anti-Semitism, the greatest and longest hatred in history, and again, I have a book explaining this called Why the Jews. I'm not trying to sell you a book. I'm just trying to tell you I've written on it, and if you're interested in me and or it, you might want to read it. It can't be coincidental. Israel is the size of El Salvador, is the size of the American state of New Jersey. So give me a break. This is the great threat that everybody hates. Israel, you know where the freest Muslims in the Middle East live? The freest Arabs in the Middle East live? In Israel. It's better to be an Arab in Israel than an Arab in just about any Arab country. You have more rights, you have more freedom, you have more chance for prosperity. Life's pretty darn good for Arabs in Israel. So why is Israel so reviled? Why is it hated? Why is there a BDS movement, boycott and divestment and sanctions, to economically strangle Israel? So what we're told, because it occupies Palestinian land. Okay. Well, did you know we have a video, we have a number of great videos at Prager University on the Middle East. David Brage gives a magnificent, magnificent video on how many times the Palestinians have turned down their having a state. 6 times they turned down a Palestinian state since 1948 to the present. Israel has not wanted to lord over Palestinians. In fact, the only reason Israel is in the West Bank is that Jordan, which was governing the West Bank, tried to destroy Israel in 1967. Israel begged, this is not opinion, it's fact. Israel begged the king of Jordan, please don't start a war with us, keep your territory. It was a defensive war, and Israel won, and Israel said, okay, how about this? Let's make peace. And the Arabs went a month after that war to Khartoum, Sudan, and announced no negotiations, no recognition, no peace. And that has been the policy ever since. There's really something morally sick about anti-Israel activity. It's morally sick. I debated this in Oxford. It's on YouTube. And do you know what the subject was? It was astonishing. The most prestigious debating forum in the world, the Oxford Union, the subject was, is Israel or Hamas the greater obstacle to Middle East peace? Hamas says our purpose is to annihilate Israel. And Israel was voted the obstacle to peace. Not the people who want to commit genocide. It's so sick. I can't overstate how, and I keep using the word sick because it is. There's something wrong. There's like a moral compass. North is south. South is north. East is west. And west is east. We have videos from South African blacks who are so angry what Israel is called an apartheid state because they lived through apartheid and they know Israel is not an apartheid state. They know what real apartheid was. We have another video up that I gave explaining the Middle East crisis. And the theme I come back to is one side wants the other side dead. That's the reason there's no peace. Hey, try this experiment. If Israel announced, we are destroying all our weapons and we'll fight no more, what would happen right after that? And if the Palestinians and the Arabs and the Iranians, who were not Arab, who were Muslim, all announced, we're destroying all our weapons and we will fight no more, what would happen a day after that? Well, here's the answer. The day after the Palestinians and the Arabs and the Muslims of the world announced, we're destroying our weapons, no more war, there would be peace in the Middle East. The day after Israel announced, we're destroying our weapons, there would be genocide in Israel. That's the difference. If you deny that, I can only say that you don't want to face reality for whatever reason. So when I hear about these anti-Israel activities on campuses, it's only a reflection on the moral state of our campuses. It's not a reflection on Israel. That's tragedy. It's like America is regarded increasingly as inherently bad, but Israel in particular. So it's worth noting it's so painful that this decent country, you know how decent, here's an example. How many of you know that during this Syrian civil war, which is about 500,000 Syrians have been slaughtered in the course of the last few years, just the last few years. It's not a big country, and 500,000 at least, not to mention how many more have fled their own country. Do you know that a number of Syrians escaped over the border, wounded Syrians, and were treated in Israel by Israeli Jewish doctors? Many of them were given surgery, of course for free, then go back to Syria. But here's the punchline. They don't tell other Syrians who saved their lives. They'll be killed. If you tell another Syrian that Jews saved my life, you're dead. That's how deep the hatred of Israel is. Just as the individual Jew in Europe was isolated for death, the individual Jewish state is isolated for death. These are unhappy facts of life. And it's a shame, it is a moral shame on anyone who joins the anti-Israel forces. Israel has no interest in occupying anybody. But if Israel withdrew from the West Bank, you know what would happen? We know what would happen. Look at what happened when Israel withdrew from Gaza. It was taken over by people who want, by terrorists. And who announced, you know what the latest announcement was? Eat Jews' livers. If you don't know that, It's because you don't want to know that. If Israel left the West Bank tomorrow, we will occupy no more Palestinians, that would just be converted to another terrorist state to try to annihilate Israel. Because what gives a lot of Palestinians meaning is not a better life for Palestinians. It is the destruction of Israel. There is no hatred in history like Jew hatred, and there's no hatred today like anti-Zionism. Hatred of the Jewish state. That's what anti-Zionism is. And if somebody says, hey, anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, tell them this. Ask them this. What would they say to somebody who said, hey, I don't think Italy has the right to exist. It should be destroyed. But I'm not anti-Italian. You would laugh at such a person. You should laugh at a person who says, oh, I'm against the Jewish state existing, but I'm not anti-Jewish. Please give me a break. These people are lying to themselves as well as to you. So happy birthday, Israel, on your 70th birthday. You're a decent country with flawed people, because flawed people are people. All people are flawed. But as it goes in the world, it's a pretty, pretty decent place. Israel hatred is unique in the world. Okie doke. The first thing to do is relight the cigar. By the way, for those of you interested, you don't normally have to relight a cigar because people regularly puff on it. But if I'm talking and not puffing, I gotta relight it. Thank you very much. Okie dokie, question time. Lauren, 28 years old, Nashville, Tennessee. We've got a lot of Tennessee viewers, you know? What tactics do you find most effective for staying grateful in times of grief, suffering, and sadness? Well, I've written a book on happiness, as it happens, and you might want to consult it. It's called Happiness is a Serious Problem. And my radio show, my national show, which is easily heard anywhere, there's an app, you can listen on AM radio, on an app, whatever, or through my website, DennisPrager.com. But every Friday, the second hour of my show, it's a three-hour show each day, and the Friday show, the second hour since 1999, has been devoted to happiness. So I give a lot of serious thought to this issue. So what's most effective for staying grateful in times of grief, suffering, and sadness? It's a very important question, and you're a thoughtful person, Lauren. There are a number of answers, and I'll have to be brief because of the time factor, but what humans need to be grateful is first they need to want to be grateful. Because without gratitude, you can't be happy and you can't be kind. Not ungrateful people are miserable, both in the sense of not happy and in the sense of how they treat others. Gratitude is the most important in many ways of the human characteristics, of the positive characteristics. So you have to want to be grateful. But what tactics, you're asking? Perspective. That's what you need in life, is perspective. When my mother died, and at a very late age, I might add, at almost 90, my parents had been together for 73 years. It was crushing to my father. My mother was, humanly speaking, his life. His other half, as he would always say. And he was crushed. But he constantly said how grateful he was that he could have her for that long. That was correct. That was the correct attitude. In fact, he wrote his autobiography, and I think it's called Attitude and Gratitude. He understood how important gratitude was, and he's right. Otherwise, no one will ever be grateful because we all lose so much. It's the nature of life. Whoever you love, you will either die before them or they will die before you. Nobody would be grateful. Now, it's harder in some cases than in others, obviously. I mean, you could say, well, look, they were together 73 years. What does he expect? And you're right. That's a correct statement. But he understood how important it was to be grateful. There are people who've lost spouses after 20 years, not after 73, and who they've loved. And what they've said to me on the radio is, I am so grateful for the 20 great years that I had. A lot of people have 0 years of happy marriage. At least I had, they would say, 20. And one goes on and goes on. And there are so many things to be grateful for. I'm not asking you to deny the loss or the grief. It's part of life, and it's very painful stuff. But most people have a lot to be grateful for. Sean, 15, in New York City, do you think a universal basic income would be a good substitute for welfare? I don't know why it would be. Why is that any different from welfare? I mean, maybe there's an answer to that, but I don't know if money that you get that you didn't earn is welfare. That's the name of the game. It's a benefit. I don't think people should get what they don't earn. You know, one of my favorite words is earn. It's a very beautiful word, and it's not enjoyed today, that word. It's not appreciated. I think you should earn the money you have. You should earn the food that you eat. Clearly, there are people, you know, who, for whatever reason, they can't work, they can't feed themselves, they have to be helped by others, clearly. But earn all happiness is earned happiness. You can't be given happiness. It has to be earned. So we'll just make a lot of unhappy people. And by the way, what happens with, it's my theory that when people get benefits that they didn't earn, when they get things for free, that's what that means, they are as addicted as people are to heroin or cocaine or opioids. And I believe it is harder to get off addiction to free money or free goods than it is to get off addiction to alcohol or drugs. It's bad for people to take stuff for free. You know, I'll tell you an interesting little anecdote here. When I was in my 20s, I wrote my first book, and I gave a speech. I was a counselor at a camp. I loved being a camp counselor. It taught me a tremendous amount working with kids. I was till I was 24. Every summer I would spend 8 weeks at a summer camp, and I was a counselor. So one of the first years, I was the head of a camp then. I was the head of a summer camp after 24. And so I wrote my first book at 25. And at 26, I became the head of this camp. And I decided at my own cost, I would give hardcover copies of my books to all the counselors. And I remember it made a permanent impression on me. As I gave them the books, I read people's faces, I think, pretty well. And I realized it didn't mean a damn thing to them because they got it for free. And I never gave a book of mine for free to anyone. I mean, I did. I mean, to friends and relatives, obviously, I do. But I mean, other than that, I say, I don't care if $5, I don't care, but I won't give it for free. What people get for free, they treat as worthless. Earning is everything. I don't believe in unconditional love. That's I wrote a piece on it, if you want to look it up on Google, if they haven't put it on the restricted list yet. And you should take a look. Let me ask you something. Those of you who believe in unconditional love, all right. You give unconditional love to a baby. Okay, I understand that. But I'm curious. Let's remove parents and children for a moment. Should spouses give unconditional love to their spouse? If a man continually beats his wife, Should she keep loving him because of unconditional love? Of course not. In fact, the happiest marriages are where people wake up every day thinking, what can I do to earn my spouse's love today? That's a good marriage. Earning is good. Jeremiah in Oxnard, California, a Prager Force member. Thank you, Jeremiah. Appreciate it very much. What do you think are the most important things to look for in a college as a young conservative? Well, since nearly all of them are awful and are intellectually and morally bankrupt, this is what I suggest. It doesn't matter. I mean, there are a handful of wonderful colleges, no question about it, that have good values. Very small number. But if you go to a regular college, your question is, what do you look for in a college as a young conservative? So unless you're going to go to an avowedly conservative college, you're going to go to a regular college that is going to try to brainwash you into how bad America is, how racist it is, how sexist, how homophobic, how xenophobic, et cetera, et cetera. They will tell you that there aren't two genders. One of the most absurd statements in the history of mankind, that there are more than two genders, which doesn't mean that there aren't people who are transgendered. That's a separate issue entirely. But there aren't more than two genders. Okay, the people who say there are, they are anti-science, I mean, to say the least. So what you need to do is have your values intact before you go to college. That's the most important. And finally, Devin, 19, in Miami. What is your definition of success? Do you consider yourself to be successful? Is there another question? It says here, last question, and then there's another one. If I want to, or it is the last question? It is? Yeah. Looking at my Prager Force people. Prager U people. Devin, 19, Miami. What is your definition of success? Do you consider yourself to be successful? success is, there are many, many answers to the question because there are many forms of success. There's family success, there's professional success, there's monetary success, there's friendship success, there's happiness success. That's one of the nice things, by the way, is that there are so many ways to be successful. We have a great video by Tom Shalhoub. It is a great video. And I hope they're all terrific, but some in my mind really stand out. That one does. Tom Shalhoub is a comic. He's a comedian. He had a show on Fox called, what was it called? Red Eye. Right. He was the host of Red Eye. It was on at 3 a.m. in New York. Midnight in on the West Coast, and he's a funny guy, and he said it's very interesting. He said many people after he would do a stand-up act at a nightclub, at a comedy club somewhere in the United States, people would often say something to the effect, and he, you know, watch it because it's he does it better than I do it because I'm just doing it out of memory. And he said people would say to him, so, are you hoping to be the next Seinfeld or something like that? And he said, do these people ask their surgeon, do you hope to be the most successful surgeon on earth? The best known surgeon in the world? He said, why did they do that to us? He said, you know, I just made X number of people laugh. That's a success. If you're only successful as a comedian, if you're Seinfeld, then nobody's successful. You have to understand, you have to make normal parameters for success. You have it, if you can sustain yourself and have a family, and your family members get along reasonably well, because family life is complex, you are a really big success. If you've touched anyone else's life, if you made someone else happier thanks to your presence in their life, you're a success. Otherwise, who's successful? Are only billionaires successful? Millionaires are not? Or if you make $60,000 a year, you're not successful? I mean, or $40,000? Isn't all of this is absurd? Or have you? Do you have friends? You're successful. You know how many people don't have friends? It has been one of the illuminating lessons of my happiness hour on my radio show that I do each week and have since 1999, because I talk about friends a great deal. The number of people who don't have one close friend is very large. Loneliness in America, I can't speak for other countries, loneliness in America is a crisis. It's an epidemic. Now, if they make a lot of money and they have a great job and a great house and a great car and all that, are they a success, but they don't have a close friend? But the guy or the woman who has close friends and makes much less money, yes, of course, it's more successful. So you have to define, what is a success? Managing life, being happy makes you successful. And you have to choose to be happy. It's one of my most important lessons about happiness. So it's the way people define success, and I'll give you an example which drives me crazy. How many young people are told success is getting into a good college, quote-unquote good college? There are very few good colleges. There are prestigious colleges. There are very few good colleges. If serious intellectual inquiry and non-ideological indoctrination are criteria of a good college, there are very few good colleges. So many young people are raised to believe a success is getting into Stanford, getting into Yale, you know, getting into UCLA, getting into this university, that university. Yes, that's a form of success. I'm not going to deny it. But you know what? I should mark this down, guys. I should open up once on the insignificance of what college you go to. It would be eye-opening for a lot of people watching. But anyway, so let's say that's a success. So what do? After 4 years at a prestigious college, then what? You're going to tell people the rest of your life you went to Harvard? People are going to say, hey, how's life? Well, you know, 14 years ago, I graduated Harvard. Nobody cares. So a lot of young people are misled as to what constitutes success. That's why it's very important. Do I consider myself successful? I considered myself successful at a very young age, because I used the criteria of, do I have friends? Am I doing what I think is meaningful work? Can I support myself and a family? Those were my criteria for success. I obviously have more success today than then. I don't live on the moon. I know that, but that's my happiness level hasn't changed. My success level has changed, but my happiness level hasn't changed. So it's a very important question. Anyway, I'm answering your question, but I never apply that to myself. I ask, am I doing good? Do I have people in my life I love and who love me? And those two are pretty big. Those are what I've asked, not am I a success? I hope this has helped. It's always great to be with you. I'm Dennis Prager. Take care.